This is Neil Rockine. Welcome to another edition of Killer Cross-Examination, the podcast where we talk to some of the top trial lawyers in the country about their practices, their habits, their styles, their approaches. This week's episode is no different. Tony Busby. Tony, I can't tell you how fired up I am. The buzz that I have, I'm sure you've heard that before, buzz around this podcast. People have been asking me, been sending me messages to get Tony Busby on, and here you are live. So welcome to the podcast, man.
I'm glad to be here, my friend. Thank you.
All right. So Tony, I always start with, and this is like to me kind of the boring part of the podcast where I like to get just some background about you and how you got to this point in your career. I'm sure you've told it before, but give me the sort of the skinny on how you ended up here.
All right. Well, you know, I went to Texas A&M on a ROTC scholarship. I went into the Marine Corps. I spent 4 years active duty as an infantry officer and as a reconnaissance officer. I served in Desert Storm and Somalia. I also patrolled the streets of L.A. during the L.A. riots. I left the Marines and came here to Houston. And went to law school, finished second in my class, and participated in mock trial and all that. I was the managing editor of our law review. Started at Sussman Godfrey here in Houston. I worked with those guys who are still my friends for a year, and then started my own law firm in a strip center. And that was about 25 years ago, and now I'm on the 75th floor of Chase Tower. Here we have the whole floor, and I think we have 20 lawyers, and you know, we're just having a good time.
So Sussman Godfrey, is that Steve Sussman? Is that
Steve was one of my mentors. Yes,
he was a legendary lawyer. I mean, one of those guys that when he walked in the courtroom, even though he had the same P number as the guy next to him, the same practice number. He was one of those guys that even when I had heard that he was coming up here to Michigan for a case, it was, you know, people were almost like lined up with like a velvet rope outside to see what the deal was.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I fashioned that about you. Tell me what kind of law you practice. I know we just saw you in the Ken Paxton impeachment trial, and you just, you know, just slayed one witness after the other. It was like putting up like Justin Verlander back when he was here in Detroit. We used to watch guys put up the, you know, the K's every time he would strike somebody out. It seemed like one witness after the other that was called by the house managers, you just turned into a witness for you. So what kind of law do you practice, and tell me about your style in court and your style of lawyering?
I do mostly personal injury. I do some business litigation. I usually when there's a big case in the Gulf South, I usually get hired. If there's a mass casualty, I usually get a call. There's six or eight law firms in the South that always are competing for that business. But we typically get the business. And you know, Astro World, you know, I represented a few of the families that lost loved ones in that. The BP oil spill, I had 14,000 clients in that litigation. Plus I had about, 25 people that were on the rig when it went down. Hmm. There's been so many over the years. It's just, we try every year to identify four or five cases that may be tried. It's hard to get that done. 1 year we tried eight cases. 1 year, that was a pretty heavy year. Back when I first started, I tried 14 cases in a year, and I'm not talking about, you know, car wrecks or DUIs. I'm talking about significant civil cases. But right now, I'm set for trial on October 23rd in a multi-district litigation case with, I think we have eight plaintiffs. Many are burned very badly. But we try cases in mostly in Texas, most of the large cities in Texas, LA, sometimes in New York, a lot of times in Louisiana, Mississippi. So, every now and then I get a call on some one-off case like Ken Paxton, like you saw in that. I also represented Governor Rick Perry here in Texas when he was indicted That was my first criminal case, and I never knew much about Rick Perry, but somebody texted me and said, "Hey, you ought to represent Rick Perry." And I said, "Well, if he calls me, I will represent him." Same with Ken Paxton. I didn't really know Ken Paxton that well. I'm doing a murder case in LA coming up in January, where two children were run over by a woman speeding, who's my client. So we kind of do. I personally do all kinds of different cases. I really don't like I get kind of bored really easily, so I try to be involved in any kind of case that interests me. Sometimes I do cases that really have no money real in play, but it's a case that interests me, or a case that's helping somebody fix something that needs to be fixed. And I'm at the point in my life where I don't fool with cases that I don't have any interest in. If I don't have an interest in it, I tell them no, or I let one of the other lawyers handle it.
There was a real cross. There was such a difference in style and an approach to your lawyering and your opponents who are representing the house managers. If you don't mind me sort of saying this, you seemed as though you were, if I didn't have the sound on and I was just watching the lawyers, right? It seemed, just by watching, that you were personally and emotionally invested in what you were doing, versus some other lawyers who look a little more, I don't know, they look a little more wrinkled.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. You know, usually in every case that I'm involved in, it's something that I personally believe in. So, not saying every lawyer has that luxury. This is something I worked for a long time to get in that position. And I understand and empathize with people that have cases that maybe they're not so excited about, but this is their job. You know, I get that. And I've been there, done that. So I'm at a point now where any case I'm involved in, I truly believe in it. So that's probably what you were seeing, is some of that passion. But on top of that, recall, and I know, you're not in Texas, but just here in Texas, that case was styled the trial of the century here in Texas. That particular proceeding and impeachment, you know, we hadn't seen one of those in over 100 years in Texas with a statewide official. The last time it had happened was Ma and Paul Ferguson, where Paul Ferguson was impeached as governor, and then his wife ran for governor. You know, a lot of history there. These are things that we learned about, and you know, we have to take Texas history in high school. So these are things that, you know, we learned as children. So it was styled as you know, the trial of the century. The individuals who were hired on behalf of the House of Representatives were considered the trial lawyers of Texas: Rusty Hardin, Dick DeGaren, who have both had a long history of success and fame in a lot of different kinds of cases. And, you know, everybody was looking forward to Tony Busby against Rusty Hardin and Dick DeGaren, because, you know, I've tangled with Rusty Hardin quite often over the last 5 or 10 years. And this was a case that people could finally see, you know, play out on their TV screens. And I was really looking forward to that as well. So, but there was a difference in style. I think they took the approach from the beginning that, you know, this is a somber occasion. This is, you know, it's historical. You know, we are hired by the house managers. You know, we're professionals. We're not going to make any objections. We're going to, you know, we're very transparent. Of course, that quickly changed when they started getting, you know, get beat up around the head and ears. You know, my approach was, you're trying to remove an elected official who received 4.2 million votes, and he's fighting for his political life. So we're going to fight. And I also knew that, you know, based on what happened in the impeachment, there may be subsequent proceedings, whether it be the FBI or other entities that might be watching and engaged. So I saw it as this was his political life. And so that's probably why I acted the way I did. I had the demeanor that I had. But also because, you know, when you're in the foxhole with somebody, the same way it was with Rick Perry, who was the first sitting governor in the history of Texas to be indicted. You know, you get really close with them very quickly. And I really felt bad for him. I felt bad, you know, despite what people think about him politically, he's a really, really nice guy, a genuine guy. And I really liked his wife, Senator Paxton, as well. And I knew a lot of the allegations that were being thrown at him were being thrown at him to embarrass him, and knowing full well that we were going to play this out in the Senate chamber while his wife, who was a senator, is watching all this play out. And she did not have the luxury of being able to step out and not watch. So there was a lot of passion involved. And I think a lot of there were six AG employees, including the Solicitor General of Texas, the head of general litigation, and a few others that had taken a leave of absence, who had been with Ken Paxton for some time in that office and were incredibly loyal to him. So there was kind of a sense that it was us against the world to some degree. And I also understood that our audience wasn't really the senators themselves. I was talking more indirectly to the senators. My audience, I believe, from the very beginning was the public watching. Mm-hmm. Anybody engaged enough to watch that on a daily basis and discuss it and tweet about it, those were the people I was trying to convince, because I knew those people would in turn convince the people in the chamber. So that probably will give you a sense of the different approaches that were taken and why I was probably a little more aggressive than I might typically be with the witnesses. You know, when you're cross-examining a witness, as you know, it depends on who they are and what they represent. In this case, the first witness, Mateer, was a very sophisticated witness. This was the guy that ran the entire office. This is an office that is as large as most large law firms in the country. This is a guy that had been nominated by Donald Trump to be a federal judge. So this was a sophisticated witness. He was a lawyer, and most would think that he would be able to handle a rigorous cross-examination. I would suggest that he was not able to, that he probably had never been in that position before on the other side mm-hmm. of that. And I also don't think he was ever a litigator. So I think, you know, although his direct, I could just tell in his direct that he was weak, and I could tell where his weaknesses were because I was paying attention to what he had to say. And I knew what the documents were. So I was probably a little more aggressive than I might typically be, but the reason was, I think, is because of who he was. And I knew that a lot of those senators were on the fence, those Republican senators. And I knew that the first witness was so critical. And I think the success we had with Mateer in the cross-examination probably kind of set the course for us to win that case.
Why do you believe that the first witness is so critical in any case, but particularly this case?
Because he was the first assistant in the office. He had been in the press. He had been held out to be the darling. He had been held out to be a hero. He had been, a lot of the press in Texas, to include the Houston Chronicle, the Dallas Morning News, the Texas Tribune, had done articles on him and about his courage and his ability to stand up to his boss and to face the ramifications of that and you know, perhaps losing his career and all these things that they reported on a long time. There was article after article. And plus, he was the key witness on the first article of impeachment. So it was, the way I tried to frame it was, here you are, the first assistant, that is the right-hand man to the attorney general, a political appointee, on the first article of impeachment, and you're the first witness. And right. You crumbled like a cookie. And that's, you know, apropos of the entire case, in my view.
The comparison, really more of a contrast. I looked at the way that, I've always understood that Rusty Hardin and Dick DeGaren were legends. I also view you as a legend, though I assume you're much younger.
yeah. Unless I've had some really good work done, I hope I'm good.
But But they seemed very folksy, and maybe that's how they always are. But you were in this case dealing it being a prosecutor is not something that generally is a natural fit for a lot of people. And I understand that maybe there's some gravitas that everybody thinks that they're, you know, well, I'm going to be gentlemanly and I'm going to be, you know, folksy about it. But there wasn't a lot of room for folksy to get the case going. I mean, the way that I viewed it, it was like you had a couple of guys that were walked into the room and they were going to like, hey, let's chat how we're going to do this. And one guy walks in and goes, we're not sitting here talking about what we're going to do. Like, we're going to do it. Like, so don't ask me what the rules are. You should know what the rules are.
Yeah.
And that's how I kind of took your approach, because the first witness, I remember parts of your cross. There were, they had problems with their timeline. They had problems with the accusations about things that they accused. It seems like they thought their timeline about repairs and work done at Ken Paxton's house, was going to be a layup. There are issues about letters that had gone out that I don't think they even envisioned that you were going to make a claim that there had been essentially how did you phrase it? That they had letters that went out without Ken Pax's name on it with the seal, that was some type of alteration of a sealed document. They looked like they were caught. I mean, like a deer in the headlights to me.
Yeah.
And I just want to ask you, when you set that bit of cross-examination up about, for example, the document, you know, and how they had sent out documents, set that up for me, because you had such a great way of doing it. And I just want to tee it up a little bit. These are lawyers. They're part of the attorney general's office. So clearly they should know the law. They can't admit that they don't know the law or they're unfamiliar with the law. There are certain things that were clear about when Ken Paxton was still in office, when these guys had sent this letter out, right? And it didn't have his name on it. And you took such a unique approach and really boxed them in. So set the stage for me a little bit. And we're going to, I'm going to play that clip.
The Constitution is what gives the Attorney General the power to act. Isn't that right?
The Constitution and the statutes passed by the legislature, yes.
Your power to act, if any, derives directly from the AG. Isn't that right?
It's derived from the AG, but it's also derived from the statutes.
Yeah. You're not authorized to take his name off his letterhead, are you?
Am I authorized to take his name off the letterhead?
I'm sorry? Is that a question?
I'm repeating your question to make sure I understand it. Could you restate it?
I can absolutely restate it. You, as deputy, as first assistant, are not authorized to remove your boss's name from his letterhead, are you?
I don't know if that's true or not.
Did you not look? I mean, aren't you a lawyer? Isn't that something you better look at before you do it?
I don't recall doing it, sir.
You don't recall sending correspondence with the attorney general's name removed?
I do not.
You wouldn't have done that, would you?
By implication of your question, it must have happened, but I don't remember.
Oh, it happened. My question is that legal?
I don't know it's illegal.
Well, did you check before you guys were sending correspondence without your boss's name on it?
I didn't personally check, no.
Well, I thought you were a rule of law guy. Isn't that what you told us? I'm a rule of law guy.
I am a rule of law guy.
Okay, rule of law guy. Is it legal to send out correspondence without your boss's name on it? Official correspondence from the AG's office?
I don't think it's illegal, no.
You don't think it's illegal?
I do not.
Is that how you decide your legal analysis, is by just whether you think it is or not?
Anytime you're I've cross-examined with lawyers before, or anytime you cross-examine somebody with some sort of specialized expertise, you know, you put them in a real box, because they can't admit, like in this instance, can't admit that this was not lawful. On the other hand, they can't admit that they don't know. So it puts them in it's like, when did you stop beating your wife? And that's kind of the position I put him in.
Such a trap. And it was a great trap too.
Yeah. And when you know you got a situation like that, one of the things you really have to do is build it up, you know, make it more significant than perhaps it is, and make it as significant as you can, such that it not only reflects upon the witness, but reflects upon the case as a whole, and maybe reflects on all the other witnesses. And maybe it suggests that it's even part of some sort of group effort and conspiracy that they did this. And so, you know, that either they didn't know, but I don't think anybody believes they did not know what the law is, but perhaps they knew what it was and purposely were violating it. There was even one witness, and I think this was when my colleague Mitch Little cross-examined Ryan Vassar, who believed, and I think they truly did believe, that when the attorney general was out of the state and he happened to be in Cleveland trying to put together a group of AGs to sue Google, that the first assistant became legally the attorney general, which I thought was ridiculous. but it would again put them in a position where they had to take this ridiculous legal position or admit that what they were doing was contrary to what they knew their boss would want. So there are a lot of those kinds of moments that when I knew they were there, I built them up in significance and made sure that, you know, again, understanding that who the audience was, the significance of it. So when I got to the punchline, everybody understood where we were all going. I think a lot of times lawyers, when they're cross-examining a witness, they think they've made a great point, but they're the only one riding the bus. And I like to make sure everybody's on the bus before I get to the punchline, because that's what makes it a whole lot more effective. And, you know, sometimes lawyers are so focused on the mechanics of all this, they forget about the persuasive part, which is the most important part. And I think that's, as far as styles go, was probably the biggest difference between us and Hardin et al., because they really believed that the senators there in the chamber, many of which were lawyers, were their audience. And I think that made them incredibly ineffective, notwithstanding also the fact that they never put together a coherent story about what they thought their case was. I don't think they ever even figured out what their case was until perhaps the second part of their closing argument. By that time, of course, it was way too late. And once Jeff Mateer took on water, and again, this should have been their strongest witness. It was their first witness. Everybody knows you start with a strong witness that's not going to take on water. Somebody who's sophisticated and it's credentialed. He should have really made their case. By the first witness, your case should be well on its way. Unfortunately for them, their first witness, they were scrambling from there forward. And then my colleague Mitch Little cross-examined Vassar. And again, he's a credentialed lawyer who worked in the office, who was responsible, you know, had responsibilities, people that reported to him. But he crumbled. I had never met Mitch Little before. I had never worked with him before. I was a little concerned about him cross-examining one of the witnesses, but the lawyer that I had assigned that to at the last minute says, I don't think I can be ready to cross-examine Ryan Vassar. And Mitch Little stepped in and said, I'll do it. And once he started doing a lot of work on it, and I didn't feel it was fair to him to say, you know, for me to try to work all night and get ready for it. So I watched that play out. And when he finished that, I personally thought that was the best cross-examination in the whole trial. When he finished, I said to him, I hope your kids were watching that. That was some of the best I've seen, and I've seen some of the best. And I think that particular clip where he got the young lawyer to say, we went to the FBI with no evidence, was pretty much exactly what we had been saying from the very first press conference that we had. And one of the things I tried to impress upon, you know, the lawyers is that we want to be saying the same thing every single time. So I'm going to say these things at this press conference, and these are the same things we're going to say in the opening statement, and these are the same things we're going to say in every cross-examination, and it's going to be the same thing I'm going to say when I do the closing argument. And I think if you look at it from that perspective, there's a lot to be learned there for young lawyers. But also, there was never a question about what our case was. Our case was this was rushed. They didn't have any evidence, and there were ulterior motives for various different people. You know, I had to explain with these whistleblowers who were hardcore Republicans, the kind of people that our attorney general would hire, you know, people that are in that world. That's the kind of people that he hired for his political appointees. I had to explain why they did what they did. I had to explain why 60 some odd Republicans voted for impeachment, which is, you know, that's what the press used all the time to give this effort credibility. Like, it wasn't just the Democrats that did this. It was a lot of Republicans. And I had to explain also, you know, some of the actions of, you know, some of the specifics, like, why do we keep talking about Texans for lawsuit reform? Why did we keep talking about George Bush? You know, I try to put all this together. And so that's what I told these guys, we're going to make our case in the cross-examinations. We're not going to turn it, because there were some people on our team was like, maybe we should, you know, they do their directs and we recall these people, you know, and I was like, there were even people on our team, if you can believe it, that had the idea that maybe we defer on our opening statement. And I was like, no, by the time we're going to win the case within the first two or three witnesses that they put up. And if we don't, we're in trouble. And luckily we did.
Because first of all, I want to play a clip.
You see that? That's the bar record of George P. Bush. You see that?
I see what the document is. I think everybody can.
Now look at the bottom. Look at the bottom entry. His law license was inactive for 10 years. See that? Look at when he requested to reactivate his license. Tell us all that date.
Where you want to point it to me?
10/1/2020. Do you see that?
I see the document says that, sir.
What date is it when he applied to activate his license?
It says October 1st,
2020. Huh. Let me get this right in my mind. On October 1st, 2020, you sent the general a text that we saw, right?
I did, yes, sir.
On that same day, you signed a letter, seven of you, right?
Yes, sir.
And coincidentally, on that same day, George P. Bush, who ran against General Paxton, did he not?
He did in the primary.
George P. Bush applies to reactivate his law license. You see that?
That's what that document appears to say.
You ever hear that old saying, there are no coincidences in Austin?
Actually, I don't. I'm not an Austin guy, so no, I haven't heard that one.
There are no coincidences in Austin. You never heard that?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Now, I'm trying to figure out the connection here. Before October 1st, you had already talked to Johnny Sutton, hadn't you?
I had not.
Somebody had, right?
I believe so.
Somebody within these seven people had, right?
I believe so.
And what's Johnny Sutton's relationship with George P. Bush?
I have no idea.
Don't know.
Any. I have no idea if there's any.
No clue.
No.
So the day after George P. Bush applies to reactivate his license, you resign. Is that right?
I resigned on October 2nd, sir.
So I'm going to tell you this. One of the things that I was particularly impressed about. I have a belief, you know the Mike Tyson saying, which is everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Yeah.
And there's a corollary, I think, in trying cases. And tell me, I think I saw this playing out in the actual Ken Paxton impeachment trial, and in what you're saying, because I can visualize it, which is that by the time they start calling their witnesses and you want to cross examine, your goal is, hey, I want them leaning one way. I want that witness to start feeling, I want them to see that there's an injury to their leg. And I want them to start leaning this way and leaning that. I'm going to keep hammering that leg and that leg and that leg. And I want them to be on the defensive and them to actually be sort of limping. And then you can begin to push them to the left and to the right. It was obvious that was what you guys were doing. I mean, even to the point that you dropped in, which I thought was Some guys didn't even catch that. You, I don't know how you caught that, but some guys caught, who was it? Was it George Bush or Neil Bush that had reactivated their.
Yeah. George P. Bush. Yeah.
Okay. Tell us about that. How did you weave that in?
Well, you know, I'm not really that engaged in the ins and outs of Republican Party politics in tech. Of course, I know all these people and I see them all the time, but I'm not really in that fight, if you will. But I was aware that there's the establishment Republicans, and then there's the more MAGA type Republicans like Ken Paxton is. And there's always this friction between those two groups. And there's always this idea of what, you know, which group is actually, you know, who really runs the state. Obviously the Republicans run the state, but the question is which group of Republicans actually run the state. And I knew that George P. Bush had run against Ken Paxton, and Paxton had beat him handily. And they're the kind of the old guard, Texans for Lawsuit Reform and groups like that had financed opponents against Ken Paxton to the tune of like $10 to $12 million they spent against him. And he's very sensitive to that. So every time we were together, he would talk about, you know, it's these guys are behind this, you know, without revealing confidences, but this is kind of what was bandied about in our rooms. And so I had somebody do some research on George P. Bush and to try to find out when because I'd heard that he had reapplied to activate his law license. And it was just by pure luck, mana from heaven, that the date that we were able to find, we only found it like a few days before that cross-examination, that he had done so on October 1, 2020, which was in fact the same day that these so-called whistleblowers went to the FBI. And of course, they all had the same lawyer. And of course, that lawyer had been appointed to be a U.S. attorney in the past by George Bush. And so there was just too many coincidences. And so part of that effort, you know, I didn't know when exactly I was going to use that with Mateer. I mean, I knew I had it in my hip pocket. The document had never even been produced. Because we didn't, as the criminal defendant, we didn't really have to produce any documents other than, you know, exhibits that we were going to offer. And I don't think there were so many documents in the case. I know my colleagues on the other side didn't have a clue what documents existed. I know they never actually reviewed them. I know that, number one, because when Rusty Hardin stood up and said, the evidence is 10 times more than the public knows. I knew he had never seen the evidence, but that's, I have a lot of history with him and I know that's his MO. But so I knew that they likely would not be too antsy about me using a document. They just assumed that it was something that you know, was in evidence or was something that had been produced. So, you know, I set that up and, but it was all part of this idea that I didn't know if it was going to go or not. It really depended upon, because I didn't talk a lot about it in the opening statement, but I had a few traps like that I had in my hip pocket, hoping that the evidence would go the way I wanted it and I could frame it the way I thought it should be framed. And he just walked right into it. And making him read from that state bar document and making him read, you know, he pretend, you know how these witnesses do. He didn't want to just read it. He had to, you know, you had to push him along, which is makes, in my view, makes it even better. The more he resists, the better it is for me. And to make him read that, I thought, you know, you could hear in that. I wish you'd have been in the chamber because there were certain moments, and I know you've been there before in trial, when you can just, those defining moments, you can feel the air in the room change. You can feel that the demeanor in the entire room change. That was one of those moments, which led me, of course, later to really continue to beat that drum about all of them had the same lawyer and he wasn't charging them anything. And the funny thing is that the presiding officer, our lieutenant governor, we had brought up Johnny Sutton, this individual who used to be the U.S. attorney under George Bush. And he had told Lieutenant Governor that he did not represent them. He said, I represent to this body that I do not represent them. So the entire time that every one of them got up there and testified that Johnny Sutton was their lawyer, and the fact that he was standing over there where everybody could see him. And even there were sometimes I was told that
the spinning camera, and looking.
The camera would pan over to him. And I would pause to let the camera pan to him just because I knew people were watching this. It really, really hurt their credibility, and it just worked out so perfectly that I couldn't even have planned it that well.
Tony, how many of your cases are publicized or are cases where there are cameras in the courtroom?
You know, that could be the very first time that I've ever tried a case in front of a camera. There's been a couple of cases where that was requested. There's been a few cases where there was a camera that was looking through the little, you know, the little hole in the court door. But that particular was played out, you know, and again, I wasn't really paying attention to that other than you can only imagine the amount of texts and emails and whatnot I got on a daily basis in the afternoons. And those were helpful to me to kind of get a sense of what was working for us, you know, what people were keying in on.
It's like a live sort of, I don't say focus, but it's a live sort of reaction focus group.
It's like a shadow jury. It's like a shadow jury, but it's made up of, you know, millions of people. And Twitter, I think personally, Twitter is a cesspool, and I try to stay off of it personally. But you learn a lot on there as far as, you know, what kind of people are thinking. And there's some MAGA right-wing Republicans, and there's, you know, obviously I knew what the liberal press thought, but you get a good sense of what's working and what's not and what's really gaining traction. And I would have them, you know, in the morning before we started, to the extent that I wasn't doing the witness, I would make sure that whoever had a speaking role that day understood, you know, what's working here. And let's make sure that if you get an opportunity, you know, bang that drum.
You appear to me to have a real sense of the moment. You know what I mean by that? You seem to really have your timing. And again, this is stuff that I've already told you, and I haven't, I felt like you sensed the gravity of it. There were moments where I thought you paused, like you crossed your arms and were almost like looking at the ceiling for a moment and paused. I got the sense that I don't want to say, because I know you're a monster beast giant, you know, King Kong lawyer with these massive cases and massive verdicts and a massive rep. But in a way, if you don't mind me saying this, it was almost like, okay, this is the Tony Busby era. Old guy's out. you went after somebody in a way that I thought was unfair. I'm here and I'm going to do, and this is my moment and this is my client's moment. It had that feeling. Do you know what I mean? It seemed like that.
I felt that way too. When just like with Rick Perry, I got multiple texts from various people that said, you know, you ought to represent Ken Paxton. He's got this lawyer, he's got this lawyer, but you ought to go represent Ken Paxton. I said, well, I'm not going to call him. I mean, if he wants me to represent him, he knows how to find me. So he ultimately did call me, and I was down in Mexico of all places, and flew back to meet with him in Frisco, and we had a meeting. And I know you probably had this situation before, but a lot of times when I get into a case, there's people that have a lot of history with a client. A lot of people are jockeying for position. People want to be called the lead and all that. And I don't really care about any of that part. I just want to make sure I was not part of a losing effort. I don't want to make sure that, you know, we were going to actually be able to be successful. But I told him that day, and he'll say this even now, he would, if you ask him, I said, I'm going to win this case and you're going to be the governor. Mark my words. And I think that's what's going to happen. And so the gravity of the moment wasn't lost on me. But, you know, you get caught up in all the back and forth and all the foolishness that happens and the fights between lawyers and the fights amongst your own, you know, your own team, which that's just par for the course. No criticism against them. All of them were very passionate, wanted to win the case. You know, just we have, there's sometimes disagreements about how to go about that. Walking in there, one of the things Lieutenant Governor did was he wanted to have a walkthrough with lead counsel the day before, and he was kind of want to talk to us. Walking in on that day, that was where it really hit me, the gravity of the situation. And, you know, kind of looking, because I'd never been in that center chamber before. And, you know, just kind of get a sense of where everything was. Of course, I wanted to know where the cameras were. I wanted to know where the witness was going to be, you know, where we're going to stand, just so I could get out, you know, in my mind. One of the things they didn't provide to the public, which I really fought to get, was so the public could see what was on our little screens, and we weren't able to make that happen. And they really pushed back. The Secretary of the Senate pushed back hard on that, and I kept trying to convince them that, look, this is a public trial. And they said, well, no, the only thing's important is the Senate. The jury sees it. Of course, you know, again, that from their point of view, that's what they thought the trial was. From my point of view, it was something completely different. The gravity of it hit me. At some point during the trial, Mitch Little became very close in that trial, because I really have great respect for him as a trial lawyer and as a person. And I forget what particular moment it was, but he tapped me and he said, "Tony, we just won the trial of the century." And I'll never forget it. It was really, and almost brought tears to my eyes. That's how moving it was to me. I do believe, and it's, you know, that it was because not just because of the way we framed the case. I think that was incredibly, the architecture of the case was key. The way we built the case and the way, you know, the architecture, but that's what I call the architecture of the case, building a case that can be won. You know, I don't think they built a case that could be won. But secondly, those cross examinations, I think, won that case because there were a lot of people on our side after we had cross examined their witnesses that felt like we don't even need to put on a witness. And you know, a lot of the guys on our team were hardcore long-term criminal defense lawyers. And I didn't see the case that way either. I thought that the public and the jury want to see that the office works, you know, that the office is not in disarray, has been suggested. It works. And to give them some additional justification for the public information requests, decisions, and also a little bit about how to hire outside counsel, just some of the, you know, very technical stuff that kind of not that important, give them a sense of comfort. So it's one thing to destroy their case and they didn't make their burden. I wanted to give them a little bit so they'd understand that office is in good shape. It's going to continue to be in good shape under Ken Paxton when you acquit him. So I think all that worked out as good as it could have. One of the things a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, we didn't know who they were actually going to call as witnesses. I had impressed upon.
What do you mean you didn't know?
Well, I mean, their witness list was 165 people and ours was correspondingly large. And we had, both sides had subpoenaed, more than 100 people, that were standing outside in a witness room. And, when we first met, even though he didn't ask for any discussion, I jumped up and asked the Lieutenant Governor, you know, and I'm the kind of guy typically in a trial when I'm the plaintiff, I don't want a 24-hour rule. I don't want a 48-hour rule. I usually say to the judge, I don't care who they call, I'll deal with them. But I'm not going to give them a playbook of my case. And there's nothing in the rules that require that. There's nothing in the civil rules that require that, either state or federal court require that. So I always push back against it. In this instance, I proposed it. Because I was trying to, you know, there is no way. I've only been in the case 60 days. I have not been at the AG's office for 10 years, like a lot of the guys on our team. There's no way I can prepare for that many cross-examinations with the millions of documents that they had produced. So he agreed to a 24-hour rule, a kind of a gentleman's agreement, if you will, that they would tell us who they intended to call the next day. But of course, like all lawyers, they play games with that. And, you know, I knew that there was no way they were going to call 12 witnesses on Monday, you know, so still had to prepare ourselves for that, right? Many witnesses every day. Yeah. And, And then on top of that, even though there was a cutoff date for the production of documents, they never stopped producing documents. Those guys produced documents up until the closing argument. There were some days they produced 12 to 15 boxes of documents at 4:30 in the afternoon.
That's very prosecutor, you know, in my experience, that's what prosecutors will commonly do. The rules are, of course, against the defense are enforced, you know, to the T.
Yes.
1201. Oh, no, wasn't filed on time. They don't have time. They need 2 weeks to respond to that. But at 1159 on a, you know what I mean, on a Friday, I get, or on a Sunday, they'll drop something.
Yeah.
Here's a new filing and you got to scramble. So we got, everybody's got to, someone drop what they're doing and now download it. We got to open it up and we got to read the sites and look at all the documents. That's a very, to this day, I can't figure out, look, you brought the case. Just when you brought the case, you should have the stuff. Like, you brought the case, have the stuff. Why are you learning and getting more stuff along the way?
These guys, we had a team of three lawyers that were reviewing documents 24/7. So I would go to bed about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'd wake up about 4 or 5, and I would text one of my guys and say, okay, was there anything in those documents that I need to know about that's surprising, that I need to concern myself with? And that's kind of how we had to operate, because they produced documents up until the closing argument. They even, in their rebuttal case, they brought forth some sort of forensic professional, financial person that wanted to do a deep dive in the documents as far as the financial documents, which luckily the judge excluded. But they never quit. I mean,
Tony, that is so hard. I don't think you got used to it and you handled it with such grace. But I mean, you went to bed at, let's just recap that. You would go to bed at what, 1 or 2, you said?
Or one,
and you'd wake up at 4 or 5.
Yeah.
And during those 3 to 4 hours or so where you're trying to get some sleep, and it's hard enough as it is in a trial to get any sleep at all, any decent sleep, right?
Yeah.
Because your mind is going. And just, I want people to sort of envision what that's like. I mean, at 1 o'clock you try to lay down, at 4 or 5 you're getting up, and your first call is, with your coffee in hand, is to your team. Like, what trust you have to have that, because you're probably a guy who likes to read the stuff.
I do, but
right,
you know, at some point you gotta delegate, you gotta have some trust. You know, if they burn you once, they won't burn you twice. But I mean, they won't burn me twice.
I understand. I know what you mean. But because I know you're, you know, someone who wants to read it all and have their, you know, we lawyers tend to be able to remember things that we've read that are significant and kind of see things on the page. And when you haven't seen the page, you have to sort of rely. And you may see things after all the trials you've had differently than someone reviewing it. So you really had to have great trust in the team that you had reviewing documents overnight.
I'll tell you, one of the hardest things that I had to learn as a lawyer is, at some point you get to a point where you have to delegate and you have to trust. Because as a young lawyer, middle of my career, I had to read every single page. I did every, you know, even when somebody else did it, I did it as well. At some point, and at some point when you get, you know, like right now I have 20 lawyers that have 20 dockets, you know, and I'm on every case, but I don't even recognize the name of a lot of the cases. And they know enough to bring me in and engage me on things that are important for the case, whether it's be a key deposition or maybe I'd have to go to a hearing. And then of course, if the case is going to be tried, but the same is true, the same ability to let go a little bit, which is very difficult to do. The best trial lawyers, I believe, are the ones that are really control freaks and want to control everything and be engaged in everything. I'm the same way. It's very hard not to be that way. But I had, you know, over the last 5-7 years, I've been able to just trust my subordinates, the ones that I've gained trust in. and let them do their work and trust them as a professional. I do agree with you that I would look at some document and the possibilities might be endless the way I could use it, whereas they may look at the document and not even think it's even important. You know, that's just the difference of creative mind or just experience or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, I had to do that, because if I hadn't have done that, there's you know, you'd just be paralyzed. There's no way you could try a case.
Tony,
not a case of that size.
I know we're pressed for time, and I don't want to take up any more of your time than I already have, because I'm so grateful for the time you've given me. But what's the difference between trying a criminal case, or which the impeachment trial really was? I mean, it was a criminal case, but it was so much more, obviously. I think ultimately, at some point, this is my take, I think law schools will ultimately, there'll be chapters and books on that impeachment trial. There aren't that many impeachment trials. I mean, there just aren't. You don't hear about it anywhere in the country. There are just very few trials that make it. People typically resolve their differences, or they don't end up. But here you have like the sitting party actually impeached, you know, one of its own, and then had to be tried. That's a very rare occurrence. I really can't even think of the number of impeachment trials that have occurred, other than the ones we've seen nationally and yours, in which you represented Attorney General Paxton. I think that will become something that will ultimately make its way into law school textbooks. I just think it will, because if a Supreme Court justice is impeached, that would be something that we would see. An attorney general is impeached, I think that's something along similar lines. Tell me, what's the difference in criminal case and approaching the civil cases and how you approach those? I know it's a big question,
I'll try to break it down.
Yeah, please.
There was a lawyer on our team that was a criminal lawyer that is a really, really, really good criminal lawyer. Been involved in a lot of criminal cases, a lot of big cases, a lot of well publicized cases. And I do see a difference in mentality between a civil lawyer and a criminal lawyer, as far as, you know, the criminal lawyer focused on, they didn't make the elements, you know, the burden of proof. Make the prosecutor do her job, that sort of thing. And I just don't take that approach. I mean, I got this criminal trial coming up in LA, a double murder case. My approach, and it may be good or bad, I don't know, but I think it worked for the Paxton trial, is to, you need a plausible story. You need to tell a story. And that's not to suggest you don't talk about the elements. That's not to suggest that you don't emphasize the burden of proof. But I firmly believed that we had to do more than just show that they couldn't prove a case, that we had to give an alternative story that was a believable story, that was a compelling story, a persuasive story. And that's what I was focused on. And anytime I'm telling a story, whether it's a micro story with the particular witness that is being cross-examined, that's part of a larger story, I'm always looking for a villain. And we went back and forth about who would be the villain in this story. And ultimately settled upon these exterior forces that were pushing this effort and this fight within the Republican Party. But again, like I suggested, we had to also explain. I never really villainized, at least I don't think I did, the whistleblowers themselves. I think they made jumped to a lot of conclusions. And as I always say, you know, took a long walk on a short pier, and it's too far, you know, you couldn't go back, just like the House of Representatives, they couldn't go back. And then there was an exterior force with ulterior motives that had taken advantage of a situation and was pressing this because of their own interests. So I do believe that I got many friends who are fighting the good fight every day down at the criminal courthouse, who are focused on the burden and on the elements. And I think there's a real difference in approach in a civil case and in a criminal case. And even though I could consider this a criminal case, I took the civil approach.
You have to have, these are human dramas,
yeah,
right? And we deal with jurors now, whether they're the senators or the general public, and it really more so in your case was the general public, but these are human dramas. I mean, they want to feel like they're aligned, that they're doing the right thing. They want to feel like in some way that there's a story they can relate to.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really clear. I want to give you a chance to just allow people to tell us, you know, about, you know, how they can find you and how they can locate you and everything else. One last thing, your style itself. Do you modify your style of lawyering to the environment you're in? For example, can you envision yourself handling things differently in LA or in New York or in Florida or in the Midwest versus how you typically handle them in
certainly at the front end. I tried a case this year in South Carolina, and you know, anytime I go into what I consider a foreign jurisdiction of people that don't know me as well as people here in Texas do, you know, I always go in with, you know, I'm a guest, I'm here, I'm gonna be on my best behavior, you know, until and usually, you know, one of the things I learned long ago, you can't pretend to be somebody else. And you know, a lot of when we were younger lawyers, we would read about, you know, don't wear flashy clothes and don't drive this car and don't do this and don't do that. And, you know, I just am who I am. Mm-hmm. And usually I don't try to pretend that I'm, you know, a humble country lawyer. I just roll in and be who mm-hmm. I am.
So
and
smart.
Usually if you're sincere about it, people accept it and understand it. I think when jurors get their baloney antenna up is when you're trying to pretend to be something that you're not. So what I found in jurisdictions like California and on the Eastern Seaboard is people are really entertained by a Texan rolling in there and being a Texan, as long as you're respectful and sincere and humble about it, which I always try to be, because ultimately, you know, you're putting your client in the hands of a decision maker that you know, they do have the power. And so I make it clear that they have that power, that I recognize that everything I'm doing is trying to help them reach a decision I think they should reach. So, but so I smart. Certainly at the so front smart. End modify, you know, and you know, a lot of judges, you know, have preconceived notions about you. Once you've been around a long time, have a preconceived notion. But one of the things I've found in almost every jurisdiction that I go to is within a day or so, the judge figures out that, you know what, there's a lot of substance behind this, that this lawyer knows what he's doing and takes care of his, you know, dots his I's and crosses his T's. And they really appreciate that. And I end up making a lot of friends that way. I had a judge in South Carolina that we tried, the federal judge, very well known, very well respected, long-term judge there, who said after the opening statement, I tried lawsuits for 30 years. I've been on the bench for almost 30 years. That's the best I've ever seen in my entire career. Mm. And I was happy that I was very happy about that and very flattered because I really respected that guy.
It's high praise, man. Yeah. Very high praise. All right. So Tony Busby, the Killer Cross Examination podcast, all the lawyers that I've interviewed, it would not have been complete. My library of fantasy lawyers, like going to fantasy camp, would not have been complete if you hadn't agreed to come on here. You really are the real deal, man. I mean,
thank you.
Really,
I really appreciate it. I really enjoy talking to you.
The real deal. Tell everybody how to find you, where you are on social media, website. I'm sure you're inundated with people who have potential new cases or what have you, but give me the rundown and how can people find you?
I'm always looking for new business. Sometimes I get hired just to come pick a jury. I've done that before. I get hired to come just try somebody's case. I do that often. My website, justwin.com, pretty easy to find, or you can Google me and social media. It's at Tony Busby.
It's justwin.com?
Yes, sir.
It's like Al Davis. Yeah, just no, win, right. Baby.
The
just
Rangers. Win. Raiders. Yeah.
All right. So justwin.com. And what was the other?
At Tony Busby on Instagram is pretty much where I am most of the time.
Fantastic. Tony, I can't thank you enough. It was honestly just, you can tell I'm tickled that you agreed to come on the podcast. I know you've got so many things happening in Texas. I understand you've got even more stuff going on. I don't think you probably are resting at all these days, but I guess you'll rest when you're old, right? Or when you're retired, when you're,
rest when I'm dead.
When you're horizontal.
That's right.
So, all right, Tony Busby, thank you for joining the Killer Cross-Examination podcast. I am so honored and glad. That was Tony Busby, one of the all-time great lawyers in the United States, and certainly As far as I'm concerned, one of the single best, maybe the best cross-examiner I've seen live. Just tore him up. Tony, thank you for joining the podcast.
Thank you, Neil. See you later, man.
All right. Thank you.